Knife presents More Linoleum Knife.
I know where I'm going.
Exclamation point.
Exclamation
point. I know where I'm going.
That's right.
I know where I'm going. It's from 1945.
Yes.
It's from Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger.
Yes, the Archers.
The Archers, they were known as.
Yes.
And the very first time I saw this, didn't you screen this in Dallas back in the day?
I can't remember. Maybe.
I swear you did.
It seems like something I would have. The first time I saw it was on a 16 millimeter print in like my, the guy who ran the USA Film Festival before I did, had actually done a Michael Powell tribute in the late 80s.
Right.
And every so often we would gather in the back of like somebody's store or something. And they would like set up a 16 projector and we would just all go back there and watch movies on like the weekends. And I remember like one time he showed us Exorcist II, The Heretic on 16.
On 16 millimeter.
Yeah, and time was I Know Where I'm Going. And what's interesting about that late 80s, early 90s resurgence for Michael Powell, I think that Martin Scorsese really kind of engineered that.
Well, yeah. That seems to be the case.
Yeah, Powell's, when he died, Powell was married to Thelma Schoonmaker, who was, still Scorsese's editor. The two of them had collaborated editing on Woodstock, and she has edited most, if not all, of his feature films.
Yeah.
And, Powell had stopped working by then, but he was still around, and he was still around to sort of receive plaudits. And so a lot of film festivals did retrospective screenings. You were seeing, like, new prints getting struck of films like A Matter of Life and Death and The Red Shoes.
Wait, you showed A Matter of Life and Death?
Yes.
Not this.
Not this.
So I didn't see this until we moved here.
I did show it to you.
All right, continue.
Yeah. Anyway, so which I think is great, and I think I wish more filmmakers had sort of a champion like that in their later years to sort of like get their due. One of my great regrets was never getting to do a tribute retrospective to George Roy Hill while he was still alive. He suffered from Parkinson's for the last several years of his life and was not particularly down for doing like public appearances and stuff, but you know, I feel like he's an under-recognized, you know, auteur, and he didn't get the opportunity that Powell did, which was to sort of like be present and, you know, kind of do that victory lap, you know.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, he's Powell and Pressburger are giants. I mean, if you've never seen The Red Shoes or Black Narcissus or Peeping Tom or Stairway to Heaven, also known as A Matter of Life and Death, or this film, you're missing out on some greats.
So they were going to make A Matter of Life and Death, but they couldn't get the cameras they needed because the United States, Hollywood had all of them.
Was this for color or for, yeah. Makes sense, yeah.
And so they said, all right, let's make a black and white movie. Let's make some other movie that'll be in black and white and we can shoot it quickly.
Sure.
And that'll be fine.
And that's
until we can get a hold of what we need for A Matter of Life and Death, we'll do this.
That's part of the plot in Their Finest, you'll recall.
Yeah.
Where they decide, where the war office is like, we're going to make this movie and we're going to make this movie in color, which is, you know, for the 40s, a very big deal.
Right. So they couldn't do it, and they decided to do this instead. They wrote the script very quickly, and its production and its release coincided with the end of the war, the end of World War II. And, I mean, it was being shot as the war was coming to a close, and when it was released, the war was ending.
Yeah.
And they were very much, I wouldn't say they were like social crusaders, but they knew what they wanted.
Well, yes.
And they knew what they wanted film to do. They wanted it to push people in a new direction after you know, the end of this horrific war.
Right.
So 1945 is also the British general election.
Oh.
And Churchill, who has led the country through the war, but who is also very conservative, mm-hmm. part of the Conservative Party, he wanted no part of sweeping social reforms when the war came to an end, but the people did.
Yes.
And so that year, in a landslide, the Labour Party beat the Conservatives.
Hmm.
Primarily with the promise of, like, rebuilding things, housing, state-sponsored education, and healthcare.
Interesting.
The NIH came along after that.
The NHS.
Sorry. We have the National Institutes of Health. They have the National Health Service, the NHS. We don't have anything over here is what we have. Anyway, the NHS came after that election.
Right.
This is known as a khaki election. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yeah. A khaki election is when a general election is greatly influenced by wartime or post-war sentiment in the air among the people.
Hmm.
And the people wanted something new. And they got it with the Labour Party. And the lasting legacy of that is the NHS, which, you know, the Conservatives have always hated and have recently really been gunning for super hard. Here's a funny thing. At that time, Winston Churchill actually said that the Labour Party would have to employ a Gestapo to impose socialism on the people. Like, after fighting the Nazis,
mm-hmm.
he's super willing to say, these people are going to be Nazis. Because that's what the Gestapo was. Yeah. These people are going to be Nazis trying to force you to have state-sponsored health care.
Oh, the post-war years. Meanwhile, America sees a commie in every pot, including anybody talking about socialized medicine.
Right. So, okay. So then comes this movie, which they have made after A Canterbury Tale.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought about it in terms of what was called the Crusade Against Materialism.
Hmm.
And in addition to this being a romantic comedy about finding love in an unexpected location, it is also a story about rejecting shallow values and building your life on something more good and decent than the pursuit of money and things.
Interesting. Yeah, no, absolutely. And also, I think in a broader sense, it's a film about, you know, that certainty that you might have at some point in your life about what you want and what you're going to do, and then what happens when you allow yourself the freedom to throw that aside.
Yeah.
And pursue something else entirely and not assume that you have everything mapped out.
Please describe the plot of this movie.
So, Wendy Hiller, the great, great Wendy Hiller, she was Eliza Doolittle in the film version of Pygmalion with Leslie Howard, the non-musical My Fair Lady. You might also know her as the elderly dowager in the original Murder on the Orient Express.
Uh-huh.
She plays a woman named Joan Webster, and
she knows where she's going.
She knows where she's going. There's a prologue in which we see that her entire life has been very much based on forward momentum and also the pursuit of the finer things.
Yes.
As a 6-year-old, you know, she wrote to Santa for silk stockings.
Yes.
She didn't get them till they were 12, and they weren't silk. And so now she is basically poised to marry the boss.
Right.
We never meet the boss. The boss is the goal in the film that we never, that she never gets to, that we never see.
But we hear that he is the richest industrialist.
Yes.
In the country.
Yes. And he is, you know.
Subtext, he made money on the war.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, he's totally, I mean, he may not be a profiteer per se, but he definitely.
Is. But he actually is.
He made a nice living off of the conflict. And so she is heading up to this island off the coast of Scotland where he has taken over a huge sort of baronial estate, I guess.
Right. And the laird of that estate is a man who has had to rent it to the richest industrialist
yes.
in the country because he needed money.
Right.
Yeah.
So she gets to the tippy top of Scotland only to find that the fog is so thick there's no way that a boat can take her out to the island of Killoran, a fictional island,
yeah.
For this wedding. So she is sort of stuck in this exceedingly quaint seaside town for several days where she gets to know the inhabitants, specifically the Laird of Killoran.
Right.
Who she doesn't realize at first is the Laird, a guy named Torquil McNeil, played by Roger Livesey. And comes to sort of like fall in love with him while trying to resist the notion of falling in love with him because she knows where she's going.
Right.
And where she's going is Killoran to marry the richest man in England.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, there's a Hallmark Christmas movie that totally borrows this plot.
Oh, really?
I mean, not totally. And I even, when we watched it this last time, I tweeted about it and I tagged the director of that film who responded that he had never seen this, but he also didn't write that movie. So I'm still curious of whether or not it was a direct lift, but there's a Hallmark Christmas movie where Candace Cameron Bure plays a, she writes.
Eyes are already glazing over. So let's discuss this as little as possible.
She writes for a bridal magazine. She has this list of all the perfect attributes that you should have in a man. And she has right. a rich fiance who ostensibly has all of those attributes. And she winds up falling in love with this, her traveling companion, this guy that she sort of gets stuck with because they get snowed in. And it turns out the one thing that the rich guy doesn't have that's on her list is that she wants a man who makes her laugh. And he doesn't do that. And so she winds up falling in love with the other dude instead.
We're wasting time.
Okay, that's it. That's all I was going to say.
All right. No more talking about terrible films. We're talking about a masterpiece.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm just talking about its ongoing impact.
Sure. The ongoing impact for me, who had never known that a crappy Hallmark movie stole everything it knew from that film, is that I kind of can't see this enough times.
Oh, no question.
I don't know how often you and I have talked about it on Linoleum Knife. Mm-hmm. I know we've mentioned it, and we've probably even recommended it before. But the fact that we've gone this long without devoting an entire episode of this to it
mm-hmm.
is weird and kind of a failure on our part. Because it's so utterly wonderful from start to finish, and there's so much going on that is, again, much more than the mechanics of a, you know, I think I'm going to marry this person, but ooh, I'm going to fall in love with this person while I'm stuck here in this town.
Right.
You get a wonderful sense of geography.
Yes.
With this movie, because it was shot in two places. Shot in a studio in London because
Roger Livesey
couldn't leave.
Yes, he was doing a play on the West End and couldn't leave London.
And it was also shot on the Isle of Mull.
Yes,
which is not far from another island on which Killoran is based.
Right,
there's actually a bay of Killoran outside off this other island, so they just called it that. And when you see Livesey on the Isle of Mull, you see the back of his body double.
Yeah.
Yeah. That and they've edited the film in such a way so that if he's outside, he is simultaneously a body double actually outside and himself in a studio close up so that you don't have to look around.
You don't see the
head. That's some That is some impeccable editing there.
Oh, yeah,
because
for
if,
sure.
I didn't know anything about that until I went and did a little research on the matter. But what you get because they shot in this place is all the real people who live there.
Yeah.
And who half of them speak Gaelic all the time. And who are kind of cut off from the world. I mean, Mull is, again, an island off the northwest coast of Scotland. And it is populated by about 3,000 people.
And there's, and they, you know, the war comes up in the dialogue. They talk about, like, how the army just left, how they had been, you know, stationed here. There's a whole thing about her, the fact, you know, that the dude is rich because she's not only getting train tickets, but getting first class sleeper train tickets.
Yeah.
When, like, at that point, all transport was just like soldier, soldier, soldier. But yeah, the town itself almost has kind of a, they don't quite go fully like Preston Sturges slash Gilmore Girls with it. But yes, they are eccentric. They have their ways.
But they are kind.
Absolutely.
And one of the themes of this film is, how do you want to live your life? Do you want to, not that there's this dichotomy between, thankfully, there's not a dichotomy imposed between the country and the city.
Yeah.
It's between one island and another island, honestly.
There's a difference between people who are taking care of each other and people who think, well, if I pay you, you'll do this for me.
Correct. So it's like, how do you want to build your life? You want to build your life on a sense of community with other people, regardless of where you happen to be? Or do you want to isolate yourself and have all the money, ultimately becoming lonely?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can buy things with your money and you can order people around with your money, but you can't make them love you. And so...
Xanadu!
Right. And so this is a story of a person who has to, in her young life, realize that what she... that the determination that served her well up to that point is going to have to be employed in a new way, or else the thing she thinks she wants is going to become the thing that
makes her unhappy.
Makes her unhappy.
Yeah. And I love the fact that there's never that sense that you often get in movies like this where it's like, here's your lesson, woman.
Right. This is absolutely not like that at all. It's a very modern film in that, again, you're not forced to pick between, you know, sophistication and rural,
agrarian,
you know,
values.
That. Nor is she expected to sort of tone down her demanding nature. Because even up to the point where she realizes what she wants instead, she's a total pain. Like, she is constantly selfishly going after the things she wants.
Consequences be damned.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter what the consequences are or who it might harm.
Yeah, who she has to mow down to get there.
Yeah, so like, it's a lesson of, it's a story that is also a lesson, and it's a lesson about why are you the dominant person here? You know, why are you going to live this way when you could live this other way? Morals aside, though, this is also just a very swoony love story.
Oh, yes.
And it's the, and even that is not without its complicating elements, because there is another character in this film named, I'm just blanking on her name. Katrina, thank you. Played by Pamela Brown.
Now, I could see a whole movie about her.
Pamela Brown was an actor who wound up marrying Michael Powell. They were falling in love on the set. I think they got married. In any case, they became a thing, married or not. Her character is clearly in love with Torkoal. We don't know if they used to be a thing, if they've never been a thing, if they maybe sometimes currently are a thing. Like, we don't quite know their specifics, but we know from the way she looks at him that she would at times rather that Joan not be there at all. And yet at the same time,
she is nothing but
kind,
yes,
and supportive
and accommodating
and good, knowing that she sees Torkoal falling for
Joan.
There's a wonderful sequence where everyone sings and dances. What they're singing is beyond me because it's all in Gaelic, but
it's a 50th anniversary party for one of the
couples.
Yeah, like one for who work at one of the big houses or something.
And then finally, this is just a staggering looking movie.
Yeah.
With so much inventive direction and editing and special effects,
mm-hmm.
That transform one thing into another, that layer images on top of each other. There is the sequence on the train. I actually went back and rewatched it this morning. The sequence on the train as she goes north is so wild. It's part like predictive. And part because you see her getting on the train and the camera pans across the train. And in a review that I read, an essay I read about the film, the person writing described that sequence of the camera panning along the train. And just before you get to her car, the camera passes by another car with an open curtain. And there's a man and a woman in that car. And then, I mean, it pans past them. It's like, blink, mm-hmm. You miss. And that man and that woman are about to, like, make love. Like, they are, to say it the old-fashioned way, they are looking at each other with this sort of, like, hello. We're here today in our private car now.
Alone at last.
It's almost like a subliminal effect in that
funny.
You get the sense that there's horniness on the edges. Right? Then she has her dream.
Where she's like, what is it? It's like the phrase from the letter that's in tune with the wheels of the train.
Uh-huh.
What's the
wheels go.
Jigga, 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 jigga.
And she goes to bed and she has this dream about getting married, but she's marrying a bunch of gears.
Yeah, she's
marrying a machine. She's marrying industry.
Yeah, the dad makes some reference about like, oh, you're marrying, you know, blah blah chemical
right.
or whatever, you know, and she kind of is.
And then in her dream, the hills that she's traveling toward in the train are covered in tartan. It feels like there's a conflict between already in her head, between knowing what she's about to do and having romantic dreams about what this place is going to be like.
Hmm.
And so that is a magnificent sequence. The other magnificent sequence is the whirlpool.
Oh, where yeah.
They shot it like outside. They shot it inside. It's just this masterful feat of editing and really intense fear. Because you're like, are they going to
sink?
Are they going to die? Is someone going to die? Even worse, is this innocent young man that you have bribed with all this money.
Right. To take you out on the boat.
And it's sort of like the straw that breaks the back of her resolve. Realizing that she just threw all this money at a guy. He risked her life.
His life.
And his, well, yeah, they risked everyone's life for cash.
Right.
And he took it because he was desperate, because he really wanted to have that money so that he could get married.
Yeah. There are consequences.
And you can feel like that moment of, you feel that moment becomes this moment of despair and a reckoning inside her where she thinks, this is the only place that, that all this money is going to take me. This is as far as it can take me.
Right. This is the kind of movie where if you know somebody who thinks, ugh, they don't like watching old movies because they're slow and boring, this is a good one to throw at them because it moves along at a clip.
Yeah.
And like you said, it is very modern in a lot of ways in its attitudes and its presentations of things. Also, baby Petula Clark.
Little tiny baby child Petula Clark is in this film as a child, as a no-nonsense child, which is, you know, give me a movie full of no-nonsense children and I can tolerate them. You know? And I think that's it. I think that is all we need to tell you about this film to entice you, to command you, to demand that you go watch it.
I Know Where I'm Going is currently streaming on the Criterion Channel. So this show, Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, is one that our Patreon subscribers at every level get a couple times a month. So we're making it free for the holidays, but if you are not a Patreon subscriber and you would like to hear more of us talking at length about one film of an earlier era, then, you know, maybe think about subscribing at patreon.com/linoleumknife. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.